this series of shiurim are about the four leading biblical commentators of medieval times, and maybe the biggest challenge is giving the first class here about Rashi, because I'm sure that everybody here knows something about Rashi, and so I'm going to try to say a few things about Rashi that perhaps you have not heard before, and so you might disagree with things that I say, and that's totally fine, and feel free to argue with me if you disagree. So let's get started. Just a little bit of background about Rashi. I assume that most people know. Rashi was born in France, studied in Germany, came back to France, was the head of a yeshiva, had many disciples. Rashi lived from 1040 till 1105. Those are perhaps the dates of any rabbi who lived in medieval times that I find easiest to remember, because somebody once taught me the joke about the student at Yeshiva University who was told that that Rashi lived from 1040 to 1105, and he said, "It's amazing what he managed to accomplish in 25 minutes." If that joke helps you to remember the dates that Rashi lived, then that's good. So 1040 to 1105, most of Rashi's lifetime was a pretty good time in for the Jews of northern France, where Rashi lived, and for the Jews of Germany, except for the last 9 years of his life, in the years of after the First Crusade, which was in 1096. One of the problems with Rashi's writings is that we do not know what books he wrote in what order. And so it's not clear to us, you know, if we're reading through his commentary on the Torah, that's what we're going to be talking about today, his commentary on the Torah. Was this written after the First Crusade or before the First Crusade? Or was it written before the First Crusade, and was it changed because of events of the First Crusade? These are things that we just do not know. The Crusades, we do know, played an extremely important role in Rashi's life. Rashi was presumably a community leader much before the First Crusade, but when the First Crusade came on, that's when he began to take stances that were that showed his greatness as a leader of the community. He wrote Tshuvot, that those Tshuvot can definitely be dated till after 1096, in the last 9 years of his life, because he's talking about Jews who converted to Christianity under force and were coming back to Judaism. We're moving to a new community and trying to come back to Judaism. And he took an extremely welcoming attitude. The issue of whether somebody who converted to Christianity would continue to be considered a Jew, Rashi was the first person to articulate the principle of the line appears in the Gemara, but in a different meaning. The line appears in the Gemara, Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, that a Jew, even if the Jew has sinned, is still a Jew. In the Gemara, the line meant Yisrael, the Jewish people, afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, the Jewish people remain the Jewish people even if they have sinned. Rashi said that this is to be applied to the individual also. We see the compassion that he had for people who converted to Christianity when out of compulsion, and the welcoming way that he extended to them in their attempt to return to Judaism. Rashi's works captured the Jewish world in an unbelievable way, both his commentary on the Bible and his commentary on the Talmud. I'll just tell you my own bias. I think the greater work, the work that I use all of the time, is his commentary on the Talmud. And the so many times it happens to me that I'm reading a Talmudic passage and I read a line in the Talmud and I don't understand it. And I look in Rashi and Rashi added one word into the text, just this brilliant teacher figuring out that the student who was reading this Talmudic passage would not be able to understand it without that one word. And adding that one word helps me all the time understanding the passage. It's possible that he is better known for his commentary on the Torah because it is read by more people, not just by Jews who study the Talmud, but also by Jews who do not study the Talmud. Eric Lowy, a former Torontonian, Professor Eric Lowy, now professor at Bar-Ilan University, just wrote a prize-winning book about how Rashi's commentary became the commentary on the Torah, how it was canonized, how it was turned into the process of turning it into a canonical work, a work that you have to read if you're going to be an educated Jew. So the purpose of Rashi's commentary on the Talmud is extremely clear. The Talmud is a very difficult book to read, and Rashi is helping you to read the Talmud. But the question of what precisely is he trying to do in his commentary on the Torah, that's the question that we are going to be looking at today, that we're going to be examining. And we'll try to do this through examples from the text. I'm going to share a screen here with you with various texts from Rashi, and then we will proceed. Okay. Rashi's commentary on the Torah. So what's he doing in his Torah commentary? Well, everybody likes to quote Rashi's statement. We should give him a chance to say himself what he's doing in his Torah commentary. He says, "Yesh midrashtei agadar rabim ufar sidrum rabotero amuchonam bibreshit rabah usha'ar midrashim va'ani lo bati ela lifshuto shel mikra." That's where many people stop reading the text. There are many agadic midrashim. Our rabbis have already arranged them in their proper place in Genesis Rabbah and in other collections of midrash. "I, however, have come to write only pshuto shel mikra, the plain meaning of the text, the contextual meaning of the text." I remember when I was on a sabbatical here in Israel many years ago, and one of my kids was received her Rashi notebook. It said on it in big letters, "Ani lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra." What I have come to do in this commentary is to write pshuto shel mikra, the plain or contextual meaning of the biblical text. But the continuation of the text, you might not recognize, those of you who studied Rashi might not recognize the precise wording here of the text. Better editions of Rashi have been coming out recently based on more manuscripts, and this appears to be the best edition, the best manuscripts attest to the wording of the end of Rashi's comment being "Ula Agada Hamiyashevet Devar Hamikra Vishimuo Davur Al Ofanav." Difficult Hebrew. Those agadot which explain the words of scripture, each word in its appropriate place. So he says that his commentary is going to be pshat, the simple meaning of the text, but it will also be, this is usually understood, the end of this comment is usually understood as meaning, if the Agadah, if the Midrash, if the legend has some basis in the words of scripture, then I will cite that Agadah. And we're going to examine this claim. What we're going to be looking at mostly today is the tension between the two things that Rashi is trying to do, the issue of pshat, the plain meaning of the text, and Agadah HaMiyashevet, agadot that work, agadot that fit, agadot that in some way go along with the words of scripture. Before we get into this, let me just start with one of my favorite examples of Rashi's brilliance as a commentator. In the and I have to say here that I learned about Bible commentaries first from my teacher Nechama Leibovich, who was like the greatest Torah scholar of the 20th century, the greatest scholar of commentaries on the Bible. I didn't actually learn this from her, but in the biography that came out after her death, I saw what Nechama had to say about this comment of Rashi. Okay, there's a verse in Genesis 18 when the angels, men, showed up at Abraham's house. He says to them, "Yukach na ma'at ma'im, v'rachatzu raglechem, v'hisha'anu tachat ha'etz." Take some, okay, he invited them to stay. "I'm going to bring some water. You should rest for a while and rest underneath the eights." And Rashi writes here, "Tachat ha'eitz, tachat ha'ilan." And this is a very surprising comment, because the assumption is Rashi does not think that he's writing his commentary for people who know Hebrew. And so presumably everybody who's reading Rashi's commentary knows what an eitz is. And if Rashi was worried that you didn't know what an eitz was, then he had opportunities before this, because in the opening chapters of Bereishit, we also have mention of various eitzim in chapter 2, the eitz hadaat tov v'ra, and Rashi does not feel the requirement to explain that an eitz is an ilan. You know, there's like no way of translating this into English. Under the tree? Under the tree. So in Nechama Leibovich's biography, they say that back in the 1930s, she was teaching a class here in Israel, and it was the class included a couple of Olim Chadashim who had just showed up in the country extremely recently. And she showed them this comment here of Rashi. And she asked everybody, "Can anybody figure out what Rashi is trying to do here in this verse?" I'm not going to open it up for comments here. Maybe somebody here has figured it out, but tell you that the story that's told in the Chama's biography is that some young woman who had made Aliyah from Germany in the 30s, like 6 weeks or 2 months beforehand, was sitting in the class and saw this comment, "Tachat ha'etz, tachat ha'ilan," and the young woman said, "Lo material," that it wasn't material. The word "etz" in Hebrew is a ambiguous word. It can mean wood and it can mean tree. And Rashi, in chapter 2 of Genesis, there was no doubt when it talks about God causing an eitz to grow from the ground, that obviously it doesn't mean causing wood to grow from the ground. It means causing a tree to grow from the ground. But Rashi wants us to know that there wasn't some kind of gazebo or porch or something like this that he was inviting them to sit underneath, but he was telling them to sit under the tree. This is just an example of the extreme care that Rashi takes when he's reading a biblical verse and looking at a simple word there like eitz and realizing that it is a potentially ambiguous word and telling you which of the two understandings should be attached to it. Okay. Now I'm going to get into the question of looking at examples of Rashi trying to struggle with the issue of Pshat and Drash. After Joseph finally tells his brothers that he is Joseph, It says, "Vayishalach et echav vayilechu, vayomer alehem al tirgazu badarech." He sent his brothers off. He accompanied them perhaps along the way, and they left. And he said to them, "Al tirgazu badarech." In our basic understanding of Hebrew, we would say, don't get angry along the way. Rashi begins his comment quoting two explanations that are found in the Talmud about this. Al tirgazu badarech, al titasku bidvar alacha shelo tirgaz alechem aderech, davar acher, al tafsiu psia gasa, v'tikansu bachama leir. So two explanations found in the Talmud say that Joseph said to his brothers, somewhat anachronistically, Joseph says to his brothers, do not engage in a halachic discussion on the way home, lest the way cause you to stray. You might get so involved in a halachic discussion. You see yeshiva boys getting involved in a halachic discussion. They forget about everything, and so that they'll lose the way. So don't talk about halacha on the way home. Get home safely. Another explanation, do not walk with large steps, but on the other hand, enter the city while it's still while the sun is still shining. Obviously, the Talmudic passage is trying to find some kind of message for us when we go for a walk along the way, when we go for a trip on the highway. You remember when we used to do things like that? We're going from one city to another. So here's advice. So Rashi quotes that, but then he says, "Lefi pshuto shel mikra, yesh lomar." But then Rashi says, okay, that's the Midrash, but let me tell you that the pshat understanding of the text, according to the plain sense of scripture, we can say that since they were ashamed, Joseph was concerned that they would perhaps quarrel on the way about his being sold, arguing with each other and saying, because of you, he was sold. You slandered him and caused us to hate him. They might start recrimination, kind of recreating what it was that led to the sale of Joseph. So here we see that Rashi is aware of the tradition of interpretation that's found in the Talmud. And here he's doing, he seems to be following the instructions that he gave for himself in that programmatic statement that we saw before. And he's giving you pshuto shel mikra, the contextual understanding of the text. Another example. Some of the opening verses in the second chapter of Exodus of Shmot, the description of Yocheved trying to hide baby Moshe. V'lo yachla od hatzafino v'tikachlo tevat gomer v'tachmerah v'chibaru v'zachet v'tasem ba'at hayeled v'tasem basuf al sfat hayor v'tetatzav achoto merachot l'deah ma yeaseh lo v'tered bat paro l'chotz al hayor v'narotea ochot al yad hayor v'tered et hateva b'toch hasuf v'tishlach et amatah v'tikacheha. So when she couldn't hide him any longer, she got a wicker basket for him and she caulked it with bitumen and pitch and she put the child into it and she placed it among the reeds by the banks of the Nile. His sister stationed herself at a distance to learn what would befall them. Daughter of Paro came down to bathe in the Nile while her maidens walked along the Nile. She spied the basket among the reeds and she sent her slave girl to fetch it. So Rashi, in his commentary on these texts, is going to quote two Midrashim, and we'll see what he does with the two Midrashim that he quotes in his commentary on this text. Okay, first of all, he quotes a Midrash that appears in the Talmud. Rabotenu amru, hochot lishon mita, lefi shemichu bach. Our rabbis explained that the word hochot means that they were going to die, that they it denotes that they died, similar to, behold, I am going to die, a verse that Esav said that we're going to see in a minute. And why did Pharaoh's servant servants deserved to die because they attempted to prevent her from saving the child. So the Midrash, the Gemara, turns this into a whole story that Pharaoh's daughter saw the baby and she said, oh, I'm going to save that baby. And but of course, we all remember that her father had said that the babies are supposed to be thrown into the Nile and they're not supposed to be saved from the Nile. They're supposed to die there in the Nile. And so Pharaoh's servant women tried to dissuade her from doing this. They tried to prevent her from doing this. This does not appear to be the simplest understanding of the text, but Rashi correctly says here, Scripture too supports them in this explanation. If this is not the meaning, why did the Torah write, and her damsels were going, the servant girls were walking along the Nile? If we look back at the verse, if you took out those five Hebrew words, the verse reads just fine. Those five words seem to be of no particular consequence here. Just read the verse. I'll read it in English without those words. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the Nile. She spied the basket among the reeds, and she sent her slave girl to fetch it. What do we need those words there? So Rashi appears to be saying here, this Midrash is based on extraneous words in the text, unnecessary words in the text, and that's why and so there's a basis for this Midrash, and that's why Rashi is including it in his commentary. Let me just warn you that this is all me building up an argument here that I'm going to try to disprove in the continuation of the class. But in the meantime, I'm trying to prove the standard understanding of Rashi, that Rashi brings a Midrash when he has a reason for bringing the Midrash. And that's what he says here. Here he says it explicitly. Scripture supports using this explanation, because otherwise we've got unnecessary words in the text. Narotel, Chotel, Yada Yor are unnecessary words. So Rashi does that with one Midrash, but at the same time, commenting on the same verses, he dismisses a Midrash by saying that it is not sufficiently grounded in the biblical text. He says, Et Amata, Amata means her handmaid, Et Chivchata. The Rabotenu Darshuhu, in that same Talmudic passage, the rabbi said that Ama does not mean a handmaid, but Ama means an outstretched arm, that she sent out her arm, Vatishlach et Amata. Perhaps they said this because they wanted to say also that all of the servant women were against Pharaoh's daughter doing this. And so they interpreted the word amata as not meaning shifchata, but as meaning her arm. But Rashi allows himself to criticize the Midrash and say that the Midrash is not sufficiently connected to the text. Aval lefi dikduk lashon hakodesh hayalo linaked amata mem degesha. There should have been a dagesh in the mem. You see the form amata, meaning her handmaid, which does not have a dagesh in the mem. And you see the word amata with a dagesh in the mem, that means her arm. And so this Midrash, Rashi is dismissing the Midrash because it is not sufficiently based in the text. Okay, let's move on to the next example of Rashi quoting a Midrash. And Nechama Leibovich actually talks about this example in her book on Bereishit. She has an essay called Darkosa Rashi Bahava Ad Midrashim. When does Rashi bring Midrashim? And again, I'll tell you that I don't actually agree with my teacher, and I have a different opinion on the subject than Nechama's opinion, but trying to build up Nahama's case, which is an interesting and strong case. It says that Yaakov, Vayazad Yaakov, Nazid, Vayavo, Isat, Min Hasateh, Vahu, Ayef, that Jacob was cooking, Esav came home from the field, and he was tired. Rashi writes, Vahu, Ayef, Beritzicha. He was faint through murdering people. He'd been involved in murder at the time. Kimada atamer, just as it says, that word ayef appears in the verse, ki aifa nafshi lehorgim. I faint before the murderers. Okay, so this looks pretty far-fetched, pretty far from the plain meaning of the biblical text, this midrash that says that Esav was ayef because he had just committed a murder or perhaps a number of murders. Rashi is quoting this explanation from the Talmud. But the Talmud actually goes to town on Esav here and says much more than this. And here's the Talmudic passage. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Chamesh Averot Avar Oto Rasha Oto Ayom. Actually, Esav committed 5 different sins on that day. Ba Al Na'ara Hamorasa. He engaged in sexual intercourse with a betrothed maiden, meaning a maiden who was betrothed to somebody else and wasn't betrothed to him. Veharageta nefesh, vechafar ba'ikar, vechafar bitzkiyata meitim, veshat et habachora. What were his 5 sins? He engaged in sexual intercourse with a betrothed maiden. He killed a person. He denied the principle of God's existence. He denied the resurrection of the dead, and he despised the birthright. Then the Talmud goes on to try to prove each of those 5 crimes to find. Now, of course, the last one, despised the birthright. Well, it says it explicitly in the text. But the other 4, they have to bring proof text to prove this. So I gave you in the English translation, I only gave you the first 2 of the proofs in order to, this shouldn't be overly complicated. So, back to the 4th line of the Hebrew. Ba'al na'ara morasa k'tiv ha'cha v'yavo esad min ha'sadeh u'k'tiv ha'tam ki v'sadeh mitza'ah. So how do we know that he raped a betrothed woman on that day? Because he uses the word sadeh, and the word sadeh is also used to describe a case of the rape of a betrothed woman in Sefer Devarim. And how do we know that he had just committed a murder? Because it says, Behu ayef, uchtiv hatam, and it says in Jeremiah, oinali ki aifa nafshi lehorgim. So in the English translation, you see the 2 proofs of those first 2. Sexual intercourse with a betrothed maiden is because in both of them it uses the word sateh, and killing a person is because in both of these texts it says ayev. Both of these might appear to us to be very far from the simple meaning of the biblical text. So why would Rashi prefer, why would he cite one of them but not cite the other one? And there is a pretty reasonable, what looks like a pretty reasonable explanation for this. What did the verse say? Just reminding ourselves again what the verse said, that the verse said that Jacob was cooking and Esav came home from the field and he was ayef. Now, of course, ayef, the more standard word meaning of the word ayef is tired. And what the text should have said, as the most famous super commentary on Rashi said, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi says, that when the text says, Vehu ayef, it should have said, Vehu ra'ev. It looks like the wrong word was used here. There's a koshi here. There's a difficulty. That's what Nechama Leibovitz, she wasn't the first, but she was the most famous person in the 20th century to teach us to do this, to ask the question every time you saw a comment of Rashi, to ask the question, ma kashe le Rashi? What's bothering Rashi? And so Nechama said, following Rabbi Eliel Mizrahi, Rashi looked at this verse that it said that Esau really wanted this food because he was ayef. He says, well, that's the wrong word. It shouldn't say that he's ayef. It ought to say that he's ra'ev. And then Mizrahi goes on to say, "Umipnei shahagada hazot krova lipshuto shel mikra heviya beferusho v'hiniach haagada shamru minasade insade ela nara morasa lefisha haagada hahi krova lefisha ein sorry she'ein haagada hahi krova lipshuto shel mikra." Reading the English translation, since this midrash is close to the plain meaning of scripture, that's why Rashi incorporated it in his commentary. But he omitted the midrash to derive from the words "from the field" to mean that Esau sinned with a betrothed woman, because that midrash is not close to the plain meaning of scripture. So again, it appears that Rashi is going along with what he said that he would do. He would be offering pshat, and he would be offering midrashim that are anchored in the biblical text to some degree. However, another great one of these super commentators on Rashi, Rabbi David Halevi Segal, the author of the book called The Taz in the 17th century, he noticed that actually he read Mizrahi's super commentary, and he read that Mizrahi claimed that the word ayef doesn't make sense here. And he raises doubts about this explanation. He quotes, Rashi said he was faint because he had been murdering people. He says, this is a little problematic. In the next verse, Esav says, give me some of that food to eat because I am ayef. Now, what does that mean? Obviously, that means he's not saying because I am a murderer. He's saying because I am hungry. That's what he said there. He began the sentence by saying, give me some of this food to eat because I am ayef. Ela vadai kai al ra'ev. Actually, the word ayef really does mean hungry. And there's another biblical verse that says, that where you can see that ayef means hungry or thirsty, longing for you like thirsty earth, nafshi ke'eretz ayefa lecha sela. And so Rav David Alevi Segal says there's actually no real difficulty in this verse, that Rashi has cited this agata despite the fact that there isn't a strong textual hook. So we might say that Rashi cites agadot not just when there's a strong textual hook, but also when there's a weak textual hook. But I am not convinced that that is the place, and that is the case. And we see here, in the continuation of that same story, you remember Esav wants some of that food that Yaakov is cooking, and Yaakov says to him, well, sell me the birthright. And then Esav says to him, Hine anochi holech lamut v'lama zeli b'chora. Look, I'm going to die. What do I need the b'chora? And Rashi offers a midrash that, as far as I can tell, and I've read the super commentaries on it, has absolutely no basis in the text and is very far from the plain meaning of the text. How does Rashi explain this? He says, Amar, ma tiva shel avoda zo. When Rashi says that when Yaakov said, sell me the birthright, what it meant was, sell me the right to be the Kohen, the one who would be doing the Avodah in the sacrificial service in the Beit HaMikdash. And so he says, so Rashi is filling in the gaps in this conversation and saying that after Yaakov said, I'd like to be the one who's doing the work in the Beit HaMikdash, they said, well, tell me about this work. Mativa shel avodazo. To which Yaakov answered, Kama azharot v'onashim tluyot v'avodako tasha shaninu ve'elu shebemitash duye yayin ufruei rosh. Amar, ani holech Jacob answered, many prohibitions and punishments and many acts involving even the punishments of death are associated with it. It's a dangerous job to be a Kohen working for the Beit HaMikdash. We all remember that before the Kohanim were appointed, that was supposed to be given to the firstborn. And for example, if a Kohen who comes after having drunk too much wine or without getting a haircut is considered to be a... is considered to have transgressed the law and to be chayav mitah, to be liable to a capital penalty, to which Esau said, if I'm going to die through it, why should I desire it? That's what the meaning of the word, hineh anochi holech lamut. If I become a Kohen, I am going to die, then... what do I need it for? This is, as I would argue, it would be extremely difficult to come up with an explanation that said that this understanding of the text that Rashi is promoting is anchored in the biblical text in any way. Where is it anchored? It is anchored in Rashi's desire that Yaakov should be a good guy, and that Esav should not be a good guy. And that Yaakov is not asking for, when he's asking for the Bechorah, the rights of the firstborn, he's not asking for the way most of the other commentators understand it, asking for a double share in his father's inheritance when he dies, following the biblical law, that's what happens to a Bechor. It isn't that Yaakov is interested in having more money. It's that Yaakov is interested in becoming the one who will do the divine service. And so he's interpreting this in such a way that Yaakov will shine and that Esav will not shine. I would argue that if we look at other texts where Rashi cites a midrash, we again see that Rashi has agendas when he's citing these midrashim that aren't necessarily connected to the plain meaning of the text. So we see it here. Actually, here's an example. Rashi's opening comment of the book on the book of Exodus, where you can easily say that there is something that Rashi is, commenting on that is in the text itself. The opening lines of the book of Exodus, name the children of Jacob who came to Egypt and say that there were 70 of them. And there is a koshi here. The koshi is that at the end, the difficulty, the problem is that in the book of Bereshit, that same list appeared in greater detail in chapter 46. So why do you need to have that list here again in the beginning of Exodus? And so it seems the midrash that Rashi is citing here is solving a textual difficulty. Ve'ele shmot b'nei Yisrael, af al pi shemina'am b'chayehim b'shmotam, chazar u'mina'an achar mitatam, lo'diya chibatam, shenim shelu kekochavim. Although scripture already enumerated them by name while they were living when they went down to Egypt in Genesis chapter 46, it enumerates them again when it tells us of their death, thus showing how beloved they were to God, that they were compared to the stars that God, it's like God keeps like counting the stars and counting the Jewish people because he loves the Jewish people so much. So you can say here that this midrash is based on a difficulty in the text. And the difficulty in the text is that it appears to be redundant to be counting and naming the people who went down to Egypt. Fine, you can explain the opening comment on the book of Exodus that way. However, can you explain the opening comment on each of the five Chumashim that way? I don't think so. And Professor Avraham Grossman, one of the leading scholars of medieval Judaica here at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, he was the one who opened my eyes to the fact that in each opening comment of Rashi on each of the five Chumashim, the same theme appears. Okay, so here's the opening comment on Exodus. Now here's the opening comment on Bereshit. Maybe just to save time, I see my time is moving along, so I'll just read it in English. Rabbi Isaac said, the Torah should have started with the verse, this month shall mark for you the beginning of all the months, which is the first commandment given to Israel. What is the reason that it started with Maaseh Bereshit, with the account of creation? Because he revealed to his people his powerful works in giving them the heritage of nations. For should the people of the world say to Israel, you are robbers, for you conquered the land of the seven nations of Canaan, Israel may reply to them, all the earth belongs to the Blessed Holy One. He created it. He gave it to whomever he pleased. When he willed, he gave it to them. And when he willed, he took it from them and he gave it to us. I'll just mention as an aside, there are some scholars who have argued that this passage is here in the opening of Rashi's commentary on the Torah because of the First Crusade, because what was going on in the last 9 years of Rashi's life? The Muslims and the Christians were killing each other about the question of which one of them owned Eretz Yisrael. And Rashi is beginning by saying, Eretz Yisrael belongs to the Jewish people. Maybe it's possible, if it were possible to prove that Rashi either wrote his commentary on the Torah in the last 9 years of his life, or he edited it in the last 9 years of life, that could be the case. Let's go on to the opening comment on Vayikra. It says, he called to Moshe, Vayikra el Moshe, Kriya. I'm reading it in English just to save time. It's an expression of affection, the same expression employed by the ministering angels when they talk to each other about God, as it says, the Kara ze el ze ve'amar, one of them called to the other. But to the prophets of the nations of the world, however, he revealed himself through expressions denoting coincidence and impurity, as the verse says, and God happened to Vayikar as opposed to Vayikra. Just the one little aleph is the difference between those two words, between Vayikar and Vayikra. But Vayikar appears in the book of Numbers. And this is not the first time that the word Vayikra appears in the Bible. And so why is Rashi making a comment here about the difference between Vayikar and Vayikra? Hard to find a basis in the text. Okay, the Midbar begins again with another counting of the people. And then Rashi says the same thing that he said in the beginning of the book of Exodus. Because they were beloved to him, God counted them often. When they left Egypt, he counted them. When many of them fell because of the sin of the golden calf, he counted them to know the number of the survivors. When he came to cause his divine presence to rest among them, he counted them. And so the theme of God constantly counting the Jewish people appears here in the opening comment of Rashi on Midbar. And the opening comment of Rashi on Devarim, the first verse in Devarim reads, Ela hadvarim asher diber Moshe al kol Yisrael be'ever hayarden, b'midbar barava mol suf ben paranu ben tofel, v'lavan v'chaserot v'dizahav. It just looks like a travelogue, this verse, but it's actually an extremely difficult verse, figuring out what it's talking about. Is this description of one place where God spoke, many places where God spoke, or is this a description that God spoke in one place about all of those other places? These are the words, Rashi says, since these are words of rebuke is coming up of the Jewish people in Sefer Devarim, Moses enumerates here all the places where they angered God. Accordingly, the text makes no explicit mention of the incidents, but rather it merely alludes to them by mentioning the names of the places out of respect for the Jewish people, out of respect for Israel. So Avraham Grossman pointed out that Rashi begins each of the five Chumashim by saying something about how special the Jewish people is. And if you want to see them again, Rashi on Shmuel saying God counts them all the time. Rashi on Breishit saying the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people and everybody should know that, and that's why the Torah began this way, so we know this. Rashi on Vayikra saying God speaks with affection when he talks to Jews, when he talks to Moshe, but he doesn't when he talks to the prophets of the nations of the world. There it's Vayikra. God, again, is always counting the Jewish people. And then in the beginning of Deuteronomy, God remembers that when he's going to rebuke the Jewish people, to do it in a nice way because of the respect that God has for the Jewish people. I remember once doing this exercise in a class at York University and asking the students if they could come up with Makashela Rashi for all five of these passages. What's bothering Rashi? And, you know, looking in the biblical verse to find that there was a difficulty in the biblical verse. And some of the students actually stood on their head and came up with theories about what was Kashe Le Rashi, what was really bothering Rashi. But it makes much more sense for me to say that Rashi was a Jewish educator who wanted, among other things, wanted Jews to feel good about being Jewish. And when he began his commentary on each of the five Chumashim, he said something nice about the way in which God treats the Jewish people. And I, as an educator, and I know there are a number of educators out there in the audience, I don't think it's an insult to say that Rashi was an educator, that Rashi was trying to get across various ideas to the Jewish people. I mentioned in the beginning in the introduction that during the events of the Crusade, he was trying to make people feel good, people who had left Judaism because they because of the compulsion of the Crusades. Rashi cited Midrashim because he felt that these Midrashim would serve some kind of purpose that he was trying to advance. Just say one more thing about Rashi's character right now, and then I'm going to skip to the end of this, of what I'm trying to argue. Rashi, of the four commentators that we are going to be doing this week and the next 3 weeks, Rashi is the only commentator who says fairly frequently, "Lo yadati." I don't know. And, you know, when you write a commentary, you don't have to comment. Rashi doesn't comment on every word in the Bible. And if you're writing a commentary and you don't understand something, you don't have to write any commentary. You don't have to write the word botnim. Okay, so now we all know what botnim, anybody who's been to Israel knows what botnim is, but that's because one of the interpretations of botnim was chosen for it. But Rashi says, I don't know what botnim are. Rabbi Machir was the brother of Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGolah, one of the leading rabbis of Germany, two generations before Rashi, who according to legend was Rabbeinu Gershom died on the day that Rashi was born. Historians now say that actually he died 12 years before Rashi was born, but anyways, it helps remember where he fits into the line of history. So Rabbi Machir wrote that it's pistachios, and that it was pistachios. And then Rashi says, Domeli Shehina Farsakin. And I think that he's saying, I don't think that Rashi knows what pistachios are, because I don't think that they had pistachios in France. And he said, well, maybe that's peaches. And There's an alternate text of Rashi in one of the best manuscripts of Rashi's commentary, the Leipzig 1 manuscript that many people today feel is the best medieval manuscript of Rashi's commentary, that doesn't have those last four words, Domeli Shena Farsakin, but it says, Ba'amar li Yisrael Yevani, Yisrael from Greece told me that they're a type of fruit like chestnuts. So Rashi's struggling. He says, and he's admitting that he doesn't know what it is. And that's because of the character of Rashi as being somebody who's willing to admit what he knows and what he does not know. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here because we are out of time. But I just wanted to share with you, kind of as a close, a surprising comment of one of the famous, and he's become over the years, my favorite one of the super commentaries about Rashi. Professor Lowy's book that I mentioned in the introduction is really concentrates on the super commentaries on Rashi. Writing a commentary on a commentary, that's not a common thing. There aren't many commentaries that somebody writes a commentary on. But one of the leading commentators was Rabbi Avraham Bokrat, who left Spain in 1492 when the Jews were expelled from Spain. And he wrote in his super commentary on Rashi, I'll read this in Hebrew and then in English, Ukhvar yadata shaharav berov psukei haTorah meniach pshat hakatuv umevi midrasham zichronam libracha. You already know, if you've gotten as far as, I'm writing in my super commentary on Deuteronomy. If you've reached as far as Deuteronomy here, you already know that on most of the verses in the Torah, Rashi does not offer pshat, and he cites midrashim of the rabbis of blessed memory. In another passage, Bokrat says, Rashi cites midrashim because they're true, and you don't have to find me any kind of proof from the text, but for the midrash is true, and that's why Rashi cites it, and I'm sure that Rashi felt that way also, that he's citing things that were true, even though he sometimes writes, I, however, have come to write only pshuto shel mikra, the plain or contextual meaning of the text. What he means is that in his commentary on that specific verse only, he would be offering, he said, when Rashi says, I know there are a whole bunch of midrashim on this, but I'm just writing the pshat here, it's his way of saying that there are midrashim, but most of the time what Rashi is doing is he is providing midrash. And I think that is what is happening. So some of you, I know that the majority of people there are in Toronto, and some of you will know Dr. Yedida Eisenstadt, who just completed a doctoral dissertation about Rashi, and she proves very nicely that what Rashi has done in his commentary on the Torah is assemble a compendium of midrashim. And it's then that leaves open the question, which Yedida tries to solve in her doctoral dissertation, of what criteria he uses for assembling this compendium of midrashim. But one of the criteria that he uses is the criterion of being an educator, of wanting to use midrashim that will be useful to his Jewish readers and that will educate them and that will turn them into good Torah Jews. Again, because many of you are in Toronto, and some of you who are as old as me or older might remember my father, Zichrono Livracha. I'll just quote something that my father once said to me. My father was not a professional Torah scholar, but he was a knowledgeable Jew. And I remember one time I gave a Dvar Torah in a shul, and he came up to me afterwards. Usually, those of you who know me know that I have this very strong interest in the pshat and the plain meaning of the biblical text. And one time after I gave a Dvar Torah in a shul, my father came up to me and said, Marty, that was a really good Dvar Torah. You know what you did? You had a lot of midrashim in that Dvar Torah that you gave. And my father said, people like midrashim. And I think that my father was a wise man and that he realized that people like Midrashim. And I think that Rashi was a wise man who realized that people like Midrashim, that Jews like Midrashim. And I'm going to stop sharing the screen and I'm going to try to unmute people if anybody wishes to say anything at this point, to ask any questions, any rebuttal or anything like this. You are now unmuted if you'd like to say anything, please.
Rashi, Marty.
Please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm learning.
No rebuttal.
Marty, Marty, I want to ask
one of my favorite Rashis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Migdal Halvonon.
Yes. Okay. Rabbi Kelman asked me to talk about the great Torah commentators, so I'm excused from saying anything about Shira Shirim here, but maybe one time we'll have a series about the great commentators on Shira Shirim. Nice to see you all. Next week we'll be doing Rashbam, Rashi's grandson. Some of you know that I have a particular interest in Rashbam, and I hope that I'll convey some of my enthusiasm about Rashbam to you next week.